start one. Maybe future tense and Tin House should have like a weird rivalry.
We used to have the best parties with with Holly and Lee and Wynn. It was either at my house or the Tin House.
Oh, a Hawthorne Tin House party?
Yeah. Well, I used to have Hawthorne happy hours, remember, Kevin?
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and it was just an excuse to get everybody in the community together and have drinks and happy hour, and then Holly would always have the Tin House. And so there was this really wonderful, always has been, camaraderie of
great sense of community. Yeah.
That's why I would never leave Portland. Every once in a while I think about, well, maybe I want to move to, and it's like, no, I can't because I'm part of this community and it's so important.
And it seems that the writers based in Portland that you guys all helped start their careers, when they do go on to a bigger publisher, they still retain a relationship with you.
Oh, definitely.
I'm thinking Monica might be one. Lydia Yuknovich, you published her memoir. Yeah. And
well, speaking of Lydia, she's going to be at our Summer Writers Workshop. So there's another connection.
Yeah.
Holly, did you want to talk a little bit about that?
Writers Workshop?
Oh, yeah, where listeners can find out about that.
I mean, that's sure. Just go to our website, tinhouse.com. Yeah, we've got a lot of great people. Robert Boswell. I mean, I can't even name. It's going to be an amazing lineup, and it's coming up July 8th. So everyone should come out and sit there at the amphitheater at Reed College. And we have readings every night featuring three amazing authors per night. It's really fun. I want lectures during the day that are really interesting. So, it's fun.
Now, as part of our round robin here, I wanted to know the qualities. What are the qualities, the skills, the talents that makes a successful independent publisher?
Passion, I think.
Energy.
Energy. Money.
Patience, I think, is one thing.
Mm-hmm. And I think really hiring the right people. I would say 90% of the people that work at Tin House are former interns. So they were super tried and true, handpicked. They're all spectacular. And I think so it's definitely the people, and make sure they're all very different, you know. Mm-hmm. So we have editors at Tin House Books that you can definitely tell which editor chose which book. And I like that. So there's different channels, you know, it's not the same.
So. My co-editor and publicist for Future Tense is Bianca Flores, who was a Tin House intern before. Yeah. And was an intern for me for a little bit, and kind of like a regular part now of Future Tense. And she actually works in she lives in New York, and she works at Harper Collins now. So,
oh wow!
but she does Future Tense stuff on the weekends. So it's like,
Harper Collins is her day job, kind of.
So.
And Rhonda, I know you have, we mentioned Liz Crane, but you also have Liz Prado, or is it Prado, Prado?
No, she doesn't work. Liz works with Laura Stanfield.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. My research is starting to melt together.
No, that's all right. It's all right. We do have a lot of interns that we share, like Sabrina was a Hawthorne intern, and now she is publicity.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
At Tin House. Because Nancy said, I need a publicist. And I said, I know one for you.
She's great.
Liz Crane started as an intern. She was way overqualified. And when I interviewed her, I said, why do you want to be an intern? You're so overqualified for this position. And so she's been with me for 10 years now. And she has written Food Lover's Guide to Portland. She edited True Portland, the Unofficial Guide for Creative People. She's an amazing writer, and she's an amazing publicist. I would be lost without Liz. Like Holly said, it's the people we work with really are, you know, integral to making this whole, you know, press working.
Now, there might be some among our two or three listeners right now, there might be one or two of them who are interested in writing a book and getting it published, or maybe they've already written. It's kind of a very difficult thing to do right now in the industry. But what advice would you give them?
Get an agent.
Yeah. Whenever I'm asked this question, I think that having an agent is always a good place to start. And also for a writer, I always tell them go to PALS and find comp titles and look at the acknowledgement page and see who was the editor of that particular book that is similar to yours. Make a list of all the editors that are similar, you know, that have chosen similar works to what you have. And then also the same agents are also acknowledged. And then mm-hmm. you can also start an agent list and then get to familiarize yourself with your market and what you're trying to do. And then when you query somebody, say, I'm querying you because I write like so-and-so, and show that you understand, you know, what they do and what is, you know, a fit for them.
Oh, right. Kevin, did you
Yeah, have well, I was just going to add that, you know, it kind of depends on what stage they're at in what they're writing, or if they've written a book already, or if they're just starting to write. When you say publish, like, you know, you could either mean publish a book or just start publishing, like, their stories or writing, so.
Yeah, I guess I meant mostly people yeah. who have a book in progress or maybe completed, and mm-hmm. then they're trying to get it out to a wider audience.
Yeah, yeah, I guess the agent would probably be the big step there. If it's something that's, you know, like a collection of essays or stories or something that can be broken apart, a good way to get attention for your work is to publish parts of that mm-hmm. book. Parts of your project in magazines or, you know, websites or whatever, and, you know, just start figuring out places where you can send stuff where your writing would fit.
Holly, does Tin yeah. House take unsolicited manuscripts? Do you read those, or they're pretty much all solicited?
For the magazine?
Yes.
For the magazine? For books, occasionally, but it's mostly agented.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But in terms of a writer wanting to get started, as Kevin said, they could publish some of their work in,
oh,
in
absolutely.
The magazine.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we love that. We work closely with books when we find something, a story that we find out if it's part of a collection or if this person could make it a collection, and then, you know, books is right on it. So mm-hmm. definitely.
Now, in a book recently published by Tin House and co-authored by, I think, the heart of our literary community here at KABU, David Naiman.
Yeah.
Ursula K. Le Guin, Conversations on Writing. David and Ursula talk about a speech that she made when accepting the National Book Foundation Medal in 2014. Actually, it got a lot of publicity. She called that her 15 minutes of fame, which is weird because I think she had about 40 or 50 years of it. But she spoke against the commodification of literature. She said, we need writers who know the difference between production of a market commodity and production of art. Are you having any trouble finding those authors for your presses?
I mostly do find the authors who know exactly that, because they have not been able to sell their work to larger publishers. That's why they come to Hawthorne. When an agent submits a manuscript to me, it's usually 95% only because they cannot sell that book to a larger house. I have a lot of examples of that. Monica Wesolowska's Holding Sylvan is one. Nobody wanted to buy that book because it's about the death of her baby. She has a baby. 8 days later, the baby dies, and they had to make some really hard choices about that. And so
they felt that wasn't commercial. Was too much
correct.
Of a downer for readers.
Right.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
I think the big publishers aren't sure how to market or publicize something. And so those are the kind of manuscripts that I get. And but those are the kind of manuscripts I want.
Yeah, that's weird, because you alluded earlier to literature, Rhonda, as something that can be comforting for people in a bad situation. I mean, blues yep. music, I think, works the same way.
Yeah.
So it's a shame that a big publisher would shy away from something like that, where you'd figure there'd be a big audience.
Well, they have to answer to a board of directors, and they have, they have to make a profit. I mean, not that I don't want to make a profit. I am for profit, but. On the other hand, you know, our model is I can publish books that will sell fewer copies, because you hope for the one that breaks out every year, every 2 years, mm-hmm. and kind of supports the entire catalog.
I had one last question for you all, and this is kind of the wrap-up one, about the future of publishing, where it's heading, and what challenges might lie ahead for all of you and for the industry in general. That's a tough one, I know. Requires
one of you
a little
guys
prognostication.
Since I just finished talking.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think right now, especially in the current, world with all of these crazy distractions and all this depressing news day after day, trying to produce art, trying to produce literature that people can connect with and escape into, it's very difficult to kind of navigate that field, because you don't want to ignore what's going on in the world. And sometimes I think people feel guilty for escaping into, you know, picking up a book or watching, you know, binge watching a TV show or whatever. But I, you know, those things are important parts of life. It can't be 24 hours of like stressing out about everything happening in the world. And I think that's a challenge for not just publishers, but anybody trying to produce art these days. So that's a big challenge right now. Not to bring everyone down.
I think Amazon poses a challenge to us.
Oh, I was going to ask about Amazon.
That's probably the biggest.
That was also mentioned, implied in Ursula's speech, and she pretty much called out, not by name, but Jeff Bezos there at Amazon for being somewhat of an obstacle, at the very least, to good literature.
Absolutely. And not only good literature, but bottom line of ours, because he undercuts, so it's hard.
And then you have the co-op fees associated with Amazon. Otherwise, I call them kickbacks.
Yeah.
Because basically, I'm not supposed to talk about this. This is how serious, what kind of a grip they have on the publishers. But I can say that they get a percentage of what they buy from us, they get back. And they call it promotion fees.
And kickback, I think, is the more descriptive word.
I can't tell you what that percentage is, but I can tell you that it exists.
And they're big enough where they can get away with that in a lot of cases.
Yeah. They say jump, and we have to say how high.
Yeah.
Well, we are ending on kind of a down note. but I think we discussed a lot of more optimistic topics, too, about books and publishing. And it is just, we're very fortunate to have you all in Portland here. As you mentioned, it's a great literary town and a very independent literary town. And thanks to Powell's and your presses. Holly MacArthur, Rhonda Hughes, and Kevin Samsel, thanks so much for joining us in the neighborhood this morning.
Thank you, Cam, for having me.
Well, we're very grateful to Holly, Rhonda, and Kevin for coming into KBOO this morning. We also scheduled Laura Stanfill of another great Portland-based indie publisher, Forest Avenue Press. But Laura couldn't make it today. She's working on her own novel and is under deadline to finish the manuscript. So to represent Forest Avenue in Laura's absence, I thought we'd play an excerpt from our Between the Covers interview last year with Forest Avenue Press editor and designer Gigi Little. Gigi edited the very entertaining and weird book, City of Weird, 30 Otherworldly Portland Tales, which was published by Forest Avenue. We talked to Gigi last year when the book came out, actually just before the book came out, along with three contributors to City of Weird, Dan DeWeese, Karen Monroe, and Susie Vitello. And here's a little from that interview. Gigi, we only have a half hour. There's so much to ask about the book, but I have to start with one perhaps unrelated question. You were a professional circus clown.
Yeah.
There's got to be a story there.
Oh, yeah, there is. I tend to go on for a long time, so how can I make it short? I married a clown, and I was in the circus for 15 years, from about 19 till 35-ish.
And then you came to Portland after the circus.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we probably should get to the book. We have to have you on later and talk about your circus days.
I don't have any evil clowns in the book.
That's right.
Nobody sent me any evil clown stories.
Okay.
Well, I never thought about that until just now.
Volume 2.
Yeah, Volume 2.
Let's get to City of Weird. How'd you come up with the idea for the book, and who were the writers and the works that inspired you?
Oh, gosh. I just really liked the idea of doing something that was novel and speculative and otherworldly, but set here. I thought it would be a fun topic to explore and to see what really literary authors would do with it. It's funny, when I think about books, what I was really inspired by wasn't books, to be honest. It was like my years as a child watching The Twilight Zone, and watching those old movies from the 50s with the monsters.
Godzilla,
and I
things like monster
stuff.
Movies.
All that stuff, yeah. Yeah, I mean, books played into it, but more than that, one of the things I've been doing a lot of recently is listening to old radio shows from like the 1950s and 60s, and I've been listening to things that they're called like escape and suspense, you know, and they're fabulous, and they're all these, and they all come from old books. So, you know, in essence, I've read those books, right?
And a lot of them come from the old pulp magazines in the 30s and 40s too. They adapted the stories for radio.
Totally, which I love, which is, you know, what I based all the graphics on in the book.
Oh, we'll talk about that a little later, about the cover. The book's title, of course, City of Weird. How would you define weird?
It's interesting because I didn't realize when I started, when I pitched this book, that there was such a thing called weird fiction. Like, I didn't know that what I
like
really
loved... genre?
It's a genre, yeah. Pretty much everything you see in the book, you know, the monsters and the spacemen and the ghosts and all that, they're under this rubric. Is that the word? Rubric? Of weird fiction. Mm-hmm. What I was thinking when I started out, though, was let's take some sci-fi, some fantasy, some, you know, ghosts and all that, and let's make it really strange and, you know, play on the Portland weird theme and kind of mush them all together. Yeah, I had no idea that that was actually a real thing.
The stories are set in Portland because of our slogan, Keep Portland Weird. Is that the main reason?
They're set there because my first idea was to set a collection in Portland. That came before, I think, you know, the idea of doing it as quote-unquote weird fiction. And then I said, hey, it really works with our slogan, you know.
Yes. Yeah, in fact, there's a great passage from one of the stories in the book. This one's called The Fixer, a Serial, by Sean Davis. And he says, and this is a quote, "Keep Portland Weird, sure. It's our slogan, but most people's commitment to this idea consists of a $3 bumper sticker.
Yeah.
There's a weird here most don't have the slightest idea about. An otherworldliness only limited by how much you can take in. If you allow yourself to see it, to really see it, it's everywhere."
Yeah.
Do you see Portland in the same way as Sean Davis?
Yeah. I was that kid in high school who wore different colored socks on purpose and you know, tried to be weird on purpose, and just moving here, you know, seeing that's free expression everywhere. I just loved it. And there are all kinds of weird here. You know, there's definitely that weird that comes on a bumper sticker, and, you know, the guy who plays the bagpipes, you know, dressed as Darth Vader and all that. But when you drill down to the individuals, everybody's got their kind of weird. Mm-hmm. And it just feels very free here, very...
You're free to be weird.
You're free to be weird. and it's not necessarily always an expression of, hey, look at me, you know? I think it's just a comfortableness that there is here.
Trying to be yourself.
Right, yeah.
The weird, we're using the term somewhat affectionately, or at the very least positively, as in Keep Portland Weird. However, it's often used as a derogatory term, meaning something different from us, the other.
Yeah.
If someone's from another culture or country, they're weird. If someone's gay or lesbian or transgender, they're weird. If something's different from what we're used to seeing or hearing, it's weird. Yeah. That definitely plays a big part in City of Weird stories.
Sure does.
Was that something you sought out from the beginning? So the kind of the darker side of weird, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
No, I didn't think about that, actually. It was an idea of, hey, Portland, give me what you got. Let's see what Portland comes up with. And I was really surprised at how dark some of these went, and how, you know, we'll talk to, like when we talked to Karen about her piece, that the sense of being other in not a positive way.
I think that's true with Dan's and Susie's piece too, in addition to Karen's.
Yeah,
In fact, I saw that in a lot of the stories in the collection.
Yeah, I was surprised by that because I was thinking about it in a slightly lighter way than some of the stories that I got, and I was very pleasantly surprised at how deep it went.
And to go even farther here, riffing on the term weird, there's a line, sometimes only a fine one, between the weird and the terrifying.
Yeah.
In the foreword to City of Weird, you write that one of the things you were looking for as you read through the submissions were, quote, I'm quoting from your foreword here, stories that exemplify what we're scared of now at the turn of the 21st century, here in this kooky city known for its weirdness, just what freaks out tattooed unicycle riding hipsters anyway. So what freaks out those hipsters?
The thing that I found is that, I mean, I didn't talk to any hipsters, but the thing that I alluded to is that, you know, what freaks weirdos out is what freaks everybody out. And that's what I think sort of the book is all about. Like, what are we really scared of? Are we really scared of a giant octopus monster, or are we really scared of being alone? The real things, all of those things that we're afraid of.
And when you talked earlier about your love for those 50s monster movies and all that, you do mention in the foreword, the fears in those days, of course, were atomic war.
Yeah.
So you had movies like Godzilla, you know, where monsters grew out of radiation. Yeah. Of course, there's fears that are more universal than that. So you said in the foreword that you're trying to figure out what is frightening people today and then using that in these horror stories or stories of the supernatural.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when you talk about fears that are, what are our big fears, what are our small fears, what are our particular fears, maybe you can put atomic war in one camp and you can put shame in another camp. I think that all fears are just as, I mean, this kind of sounds silly, they're just as valid, you know, obviously they are. I just like the juxtaposition of a fear that's kind of ridiculous and a fear that's really, really true. And that was one of the things when a story did that, that really, you know, ding, that moved on to the next level. You know, I wanted that story.
Yeah, from reading all the stories, so all 30 stories, I saw at least two big fears that were playing out. Kind of common theme that was going on in several of the stories. One's truly universal, and that's the fear of losing those we love.
Mm-hmm.
And those were often very touching and moving stories in the book, though almost you know, the kind that brings a little shiver to the back of your neck and, you know, ooh. And a lot of those are kind of ghost stories, that style. The other fear is not unique to Portland, but it's a big part of our lives here now. And that's the fear of displacement. And we'll get to Dan's story, which I think does quite a job on that.
Yeah.
Of being forced out of our homes, of our neighborhoods, our planet, in case of the story. And the fear we are powerless to do anything about it.
Yeah.
Did you have this in mind when selecting the stories? Some of these big universal fears?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I just, the fears that spoke to me, I was really obsessed with the earthquake thing. I just bought a house this last year as well, and the whole time that I was buying the house, I was thinking of buying a house in a place where there's earthquakes going to come, we're going to all die or whatever, you know. I was very kind of obsessed with it, and that sense of powerlessness that we all have. A lot of my selections were just instinctive, like, what works for me? I don't know why this works for me. I don't know why this works for me. And then when I looked at it later, I saw that a lot of it was that powerless thing. And loneliness was a big thing in there, too.
Oh, definitely.
You know, again, to your first point about people
losing
being
people
lost.
You love.
Yeah, yeah. Who do we lose and how do we lose ourselves, I guess, is what the bigger picture is in the book.
Gigi, I wondered, when you were looking for submissions, how'd you get the word out to Susie and to Dan and to Karen, people like that in the book? And what'd you tell the writers that you were looking for?
We put the word out through a number of publications, and we did a lot of just pushing things out on Facebook. I think that Portland is a very closely knit literary community, and it didn't take much doing to put the word out so that Portland writers knew what was going on, you know.
Was that through the grapevine kind of thing? Or you told one person who told another?
Through the Twitters and Facebooks, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, and we would go and, you know, I would ask people, you know, specifically all three of these people, I was like, you know, will you please give me a story? There were a lot of people that I knew. I really liked their work. There were a lot of ways that we kind of set the fish line out or whatever.
Welcome back to Mr. Jones's Neighborhood here on KABU Community Radio, or KABU Neighborhood Radio, as I like to call it. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation. Since our guests on today's show are three of Portland's publishing luminaries, Holly MacArthur, Rhonda Hughes, and Kevin Samsel, I thought we'd continue the theme of reading, writing, and books by playing a few songs on the subject. Well, we have time for two at least. Here's a little medley for your Friday brunch time listening pleasure.
Paperback writer. Yes, sir or madam, will you read my book? It took me years to write. Will you take a look? It's based on a novel by a man named Lear, and I need a job, so I want to be a paperback writer.
wonder, wonder who, who wrote the book of love? Tell me, tell me, tell me, Pope, who wrote the book of love? I've got to know the answer. Was it someone from above? I wonder, wonder who wrote the book of love? I love you, darling, baby, you know I do. The book of love. Chapter 1 says the lover, you love her with all your heart. Chapter 2, you tell her, you're never, 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 ever going to part. In chapter 3, remember the meaning of romance. In chapter 4, you break up, but you give her just one more chance. Oh, I wonder, wonder who wrote the book of love. Yes, I do. Well, it says so in this book of love. Ours is the one that's true. I wonder, wonder who wrote the book of love. Chapter 1 says to love her, you love her with all your heart. Chapter 2, you tell her, you never, 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 ever gonna part. In chapter 3, remember the meaning of romance. In chapter 4, you break up, but you give her just one more chance. Oh, I wonder, wonder who wrote the book of love.
Baby, 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 I love you, yes I do. Well, it says so in this book of love, ours is the one that's true.
Wonder, wonder who wrote the book of love.
That was a Mr. Jones's Neighborhood two-song medley, which I guess hardly qualifies for a medley, all about books. We started it off with the Beatles doing Paperback Writer and then heard the Monotones doing Book of Love from 1957. Well, that's all for this episode of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood. A big neighborhood thank you to Holly MacArthur of Tin House, Rhonda Hughes of Hawthorne Books, and Kevin Samsel of Future Tense Books for joining us live today in the KBOO studios. Please help support your indie publishers and pick up a few of their books for your summer reading. And I can't leave without giving a big thank you to our engineer and KBOO Public Affairs Director, the inimitable, unparalleled, incorrigible, irreparable, and what a mensch, Derek Crooks. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying hope it's always a beautiful day in your neighborhood.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Hood River and the Gorge at 91.9 FM, Philomath and Corvallis at 104.3 FM, and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
I hate a song that makes you think that you're not any good. I hate a song that makes you think you're just born to lose, bound to lose. No good to nobody, no good for nothing. Because you're either too old or too young or too fat or too thin or too ugly or too this or too that. Songs that run you down or songs that poke fun at you. on account of your bad luck or your hard traveling. I am out to fight those kind of songs to my very last breath of air and my last drop of blood. I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that will make you take pride in yourself.